It is 1:45 p.m. on Tuesday, October 22nd. This is the in-person interview of SLAM Arizona Incorporated. The board and technical review panel appreciate that you have come today. We understand that the application process requires time, effort, and intensive commitment, and we wish to thank you for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children of Arizona. The purpose of this interview is for the applicant to demonstrate how well it understands and has thought through the plan presented in the written application. The interview panel will use the responses to the questions to evaluate the capacity of the applicant to successfully implement the plan as outlined in the application. We will start with the introduction of the interview panel.
My name is Tracy Kelly. I am based in Connecticut and I have my own consulting business. And I typically specialize in compliance and operational issues.
I'm Susan Channon, Executive Director of Keeman Academy of Learning, a K-12 charter school in Northwest Arizona. And I am versed in all three areas, the education, operation, and finance.
And I am Peter Boyle, founder and principal of Western School of Science and Technology, which is a tuition-free public charter here in West Phoenix, serving grades 7 through 12. And I also am experienced in the academic, operational, and business plans.
This, at the end of the table, is Rachel Hanna, the Assistant Director of Charter Support and Accountability. And next to me is Jesse Berg, Accountability Specialist, who is here for training purposes. I will now go over the details of today's interview. This interview will last 90 minutes. The procedures and ground rules for the interview process are as follows. You will be given 5 minutes for introductions and to make your opening statement. I will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining and when 5 minutes is complete, so that you're aware. Expect to spend 2 to 3 minutes on the initial response to each question, allowing time for any follow-up questions to be made by the interview panel, and feel free to ask for clarification. In order to give you the opportunity to respond to all of our questions during the response to an individual question, the TRP team lead, which is Susan, may ask you to move on and give you the opportunity to address any other responses in your closing statement. When 10 minutes remain in the interview period, you will be asked to make a closing statement of no more than 5 minutes. We will conclude the interview with a description of the next steps. Do you have any questions about the procedure or the ground rules for this interview?
I just have one. The introduction is 5 minutes total, or it's our intro and personal introductions, 5 minutes each?
Time's up. Susan, are you comfortable doing intros and then 5 minute open?
Yes.
As long as they keep their intros to 3 minutes?
Sure. Okay. Intros and then your 5 minute opening, okay?
Okay.
I will now turn things over to the TRP team lead, who will be running the interview from here.
So please introduce your team and include what role each member played in the application process, as well as what role each member intends to have if the charter is approved. You can start down here so we can write these names down.
Sure. My name is Alex Tamargo, T-A-M-A-R-G-O. I am SLAM's Chief Academic Officer. I am also SLAM's Family Principal. I supported the curriculum piece of this application. And part of my job is to A, keep my finger on the pulse at SLAM, make sure things are running with fidelity as we want to see them, and also to provide professional development for our teachers and administrators.
Thank you. Good afternoon, I think we're on the other time zone. good afternoon, my name is Millie Sanchez. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the SLAM Network Schools. I also support the SLAM Foundation. I'm 21 years in the education field. I've been a charter school teacher, administrator, and I'm now on board with SLAM to help support our schools across all states that we're in. My role with this application, I worked on the application along with this team in terms, particularly on the curriculum end, but also on the research and looking and working on the outreach efforts for the community we intend to serve, which is myself. Is it for me?
Good morning or good afternoon, everybody. My name is Tony Mesa. I'm the vice chairman of SLAM, and by day, I'm an attorney in Miami, Florida, and my role is I provide support in the role of board governance, financial oversight, and legal support for the SLAMs. We're a network of 10 schools in 4 different states, and that's my role.
afternoon, everybody. My name is Rene Ruiz. I'm one of the founders of SLAM. I'm the SLAM president and the chairman of the board for each of the SLAM schools and the SLAM Foundation. I also am an attorney as my day job. I'm a labor attorney. So I help not only oversee the entire application process and the replication of our schools nationwide, but with a particular emphasis on legal issues and staffing and labor issues in the schools. I'll get into a little bit more on the intro, but I only have 3 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Alina Lopez, and I am also one of the founding board members of SLAM. I've been in the charter school system for 21 years now, as an educator, teacher, administrator, and I provide educational support as a board member.
Good afternoon. My name is Kelly Pierce. I was one of the founding teachers at SLAM Miami, and then transitioned to a position with Academica, and I specifically support the SLAM models, heavily work in developing the curriculum for our SLAM models and then the implementation of that as well. So work very closely with Millie on the application, and then moving forward will help support the opening and the success of the school moving forward.
Thank you. Now you have 5 minutes to do your opening statement.
It's going to be a challenge to condense this story into 5 minutes. Let me tell you how it began. In 2002, I started working as a board chair for at a small charter school in Miami. Somebody I worked with had asked me to take over for him, and I enjoyed doing that. Over the next 5 or 6 years, I learned a lot about how charter school runs, and I got a particular interest in education that I really didn't have before that point. By 2009, a friend introduces me to Pitbull. And Pitbull starts talking about wanting to leave an impact. You know, his personal story is one where he felt that the traditional public school model had failed him. He had been in numerous schools, and it was very late in his life when somebody finally told him, hey, listen, you have a talent, you need to apply yourself, and this is why school is important. So he convinced me to help him create the idea for a charter school. And in the beginning, he wanted it to be focused on music, and he had some ideas, and I'm a big sports fan, so, us two and other people that helped shape the vision created this concept of SLAM, which is Sports Leadership, Arts, and Management. And the idea is using sports as a hook two different ways. Not only to get kids interested in learning, like for instance, I'm not a fan of math, that's probably why I went to law school, but it wasn't until somebody pointed out that, I used to do baseball ERAs and batting averages in my head, and you're doing math. Until somebody put it in those terms, to me, it didn't become relevant. So our main mission is to use that as the hook that gets these kids to want to voluntarily come to our school. It's a public charter school, free to everybody who attends. Once we do that, our goal, once we get them, is to, number one, make them believe that they're going to go to college, that it's a realistic option for them, and hopefully prepare them as they matriculate from elementary to middle to high school, that they will be prepared to have hands-on experience to have jobs in the sports industry. We're not interested in creating athletes. I mean, if we do, we have one kid who's on the verge of joining the LA Dodgers, and that'll be fantastic, and we'll celebrate him a lot. But what we really want to do is create the people who will go and be part of this sports industry, which creates the infrastructure that allows these athletes to flourish. The people who design the uniforms and costumes, and the people who come up with the musical scores that are used in games, and sell the food and prepare the food, and the entrepreneurs who sell concessions and work with the parking. General managers of teams. I mean, these are the people that we want to create and we want to help get there. So we opened up our first school in Miami in 2013. We were blown away by the amount of interest we had. We're in the middle of Little Havana. We are, I think, 98% minority in that school. Everybody is on free or reduced lunch, tremendous poverty level. And what we saw was that very quickly our facility became the beacon of hope in the community. If we would be open the entire weekend, the kids would not leave. If we'd be open 24 hours a day, the kids wouldn't leave. I noticed a couple years back when we were designing phase two, which we now have a second beautiful building across from our original one, that never once had I had to pay to paint the exterior of the building. No one had ever put graffiti on our building, which was amazing because when you look at the surrounding neighborhood, all you see is graffiti throughout much of the little map. But yet, to me, I took that as very inspiring that, even the people who don't go to the school see it as what it is, which is an avenue for people to better themselves and go and make a lasting impact in the community and beyond for our country. We very quickly saw that we had something special and we sought to replicate it. So we went and we went to Henderson in Las Vegas. We had tremendous success there, obviously different challenges in the sense that we had a lot more space. Just a lot of things that I could speak for all day about things, how we improve things and make things better, and went out to a community that demographically was similar, but obviously very different place. You know, Miami was an urban setting, our building went north, you know, was 7 stories big, we didn't really have a lot of land, as opposed to having a tremendous amount of money. A tremendous success story. We've expanded to 10 different facilities. We're in 4 different states. We, in year one, have outperformed the traditional public school by every measure in our locations. We traditionally, we seek to serve underprivileged populations. We seek to go to places where the community embraces school choice and we have the wind at our back. We've been very fortunate that we've had municipalities around the country reach out to us and invite us to come in. That's one of the reasons why we're here and why we seek to go to Mesa in particular. Arizona is a tremendous state that favors and embraces innovation, so that's primarily the type of place we want to be. Arizona is a place that favors choice, and Mesa in particular, I've gotten to know it very well over the last 10 years, is a place that really mirrors our demographics, and hopefully it'll be number 11 in our mission to go and help create a pathway for children who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to go and become the best version of themselves.
All right. We have questions. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
All right. In Section A2, you use the Mesa Public Schools as your baseline for expected performance. Two-part question. Why did you not include any of the charter schools in Mesa in that baseline data? And then what specific area of Mesa are you targeting? Because Mesa is very large.
Let me first start by addressing where we would like to be. The answer is right now we don't know. We know that Mesa is very large. My preference would be, we have done this before, I would like to partner with Major League Baseball and partner with the Chicago Cubs and be in Sloan Park. I like that area of Mesa. It's obviously an area where the community has decided to invest resources. It has means by which people can easily access it. We have some partnerships with Major League Baseball. We took over the facility in Kissimmee, Florida that the Houston Astros vacated when they moved to their new facility. So we actually run our Kissimmee County, Osceola County campus out of a baseball stadium. So we contracted with an independent baseball league team that plays there. Our kids run concessions. They do everything from shadowing the general manager to doing hands-on exactly what we would love for them to hopefully gain a passion for. But there are several options. My primary option would be in Sloan Park if we can make that happen.
And just to answer the question on the demographics, when we were looking at this originally, when we first came out about a year ago, we were looking at areas to be in. We actually looked at a facility that looked great in terms of the facility and the way growing into phases, starting with a K-5 and being able to have a separate middle high school program and have the space that we needed. In doing our homework and speaking with the community members, we realized that it wasn't really an area where there would be the need that we were trying to fill. Having done that, the reason that the application kind of covers, and I believe the statistics were based on just overall the Mesa Unified Schools, which I know covers beyond the city of Mesa. But at that time, we didn't really want to put ourselves and say, we're going to go here and not have the right demographics. So we were looking at the district overall. And one of the things that we noticed about that district is that when you go actually into the city of Mesa, you're going to see higher demographics in terms of minority students and students with low socioeconomic status than what we actually targeted. But at the time, we didn't have a set area. So we wanted to be careful in terms of applying for an area and saying, coming back, we got approved and saying, that's not where we're going. So that's why it was kind of a general overview. I presume that it includes the 8 charter schools because of it was the state-based data from the state demographics of the district. But again,
it would only be the district.
It would only be.
You would have to do the math and include the charter school students in that.
Because there are pretty big charter schools out in Mesa.
Right.
Right. That would have an impact on students you would receive or that you would compare yourself to. Got it.
Yeah.
And I guess traditionally what we're used to is we kind of compare ourselves to the local district because we realize because there are some limited choice programs, usually the students that are in charter schools don't kind of move around from one charter school to another. So we were kind of looking at what traditionally would be. To your point, as we turned in the application, as we continued to meet with the community, we actually had an opportunity to meet with the mayor of Mesa. And he was very supportive. He actually wants to partner with us. And that is why Sloan Park and that area became more lucrative. So he recommended we look at Dobson Ranch. Actually, he even recommended like the downtown area by the community college is very lucrative because Banner Medical is right there. I know they're all over the place, but one of the reasons we had identified the first facility was we wanted to have a partnership with the medical aspect. As we, obviously not in the K-5 space, but as we grow, one of our academies is in sports medicine. And that relies heavily on having the community college programs coming in and working with the school, as well as those private partners to offer the internships and the mentorship programs. That's what we do in our schools now, in the high school space. So we want to be able to have the right location. And that's kind of where we kind of went back to the table and said, we really need to meet with the community. The mayor was like, let me know what we can do. So we're looking at areas that they've recommended. We're actually meeting with their vice mayor and the city council as a follow-up. And our goal is to request that planning year to really be able to have, to really be able to find the adequate facility that's going to serve students in that area.
Okay, let me follow up with that. Your charter says you're open to fall of 2020.
Right, right. I think we originally applied, yes.
Okay.
And is that changing?
We're
requesting to be able to have a plan here. Because again, where we were looking at is now not necessarily, you know, the goal is to have the right partners.
And we've used that strategy with great success in other places. We'd rather do it right than do it quickly. So I mean, we identify the leader. Sometimes we move the leader to another facility to shadow another proven leader just to make sure that they all understand our unique culture before they come and try to replicate.
And I think obviously the grant is also being able to apply for the charter schools grant is a big incentive
yes.
to the school. And very important.
Absolutely.
So,
Okay. Thank you. Tracy.
So you have a very unique school mission, right? We're very familiar with certification, so we don't kind of need to go through that. But one question we did have is that in week one, we're wondering is 1 week of pre-service training enough to teach teachers how to simplify things and instill in your staff the methods and strategies they'll need to implement this mission? I mean, speak about how you came to a week. What's the rationale supporting that decision?
Yes.
By obedience.
The answer is yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's an ongoing process. Yes. So in a week, we bring members from our network to the different schools and to the schools to train teachers in a new school, learning how to slamify can be difficult. So we tell them, hey, there's no right or wrong way to do it. Let's try it. Part of our common board configuration in the classroom includes the slamified section. So when the leaders walk in or we walk into a room, we can see exactly what they're talking about and ask the kids. And so, the first thing we teach is stay away from playing games. You're not here to shoot a basket after you get the question right. That's not what we're talking about. But it's evolved into some tremendous lessons. For example, teaching World War II to introduce it to students, what terminology derives from war used in sport. And they start talking about the bomb and the trenches and the blitz. So now you're football, right?
Right. So. And we saw some really great examples. Let me just push a little bit in terms of how are we monitoring lesson plans, right? So, yeah, you can teach them how to do it, but that requires just a lot of planning.
So, well, I give you the consensus on that because I mean I helped to create the curriculum, and at the time when we think of curriculum, it's a living document. It's not something that you created 6 years ago and expect it to be the same thing. And I think our whole program is based on that. Principals are CEOs. They're really the leaders of their schools because we're in different states and they need to build a culture. So we really focus heavily on that leader and what that leader brings to the table. We don't expect to come in and be able to start implementing these things. We do help support, and that is what the foundation does, Alex and her team. And I want to specify that that team is actual expert teachers in each of the schools who spend all summer actually traveling and doing that initial PD. They form relationships, which is the basis of our model. And then those, they become kind of like pen pals. We have a database of lessons where that English teacher from a new school has an English teacher who's supporting her at a different school.
Throughout the school year.
Throughout the school year.
That's
and then on the foundation end, we go and we are monitoring. We were just in Atlanta, actually.
I was going to say, Alex has been there three times since the start of
this school year. So we just monitor with the principal what that plan looks like and are they meeting their goals. And then on the solidified end, it's really the school leader is driving that. They're doing walkthroughs. They're seeing if it's happening. Is the engagement. The lesson plans are turned into the principal. And obviously, when we go, we see it. You see it. You know, you walk into a room if you're an educator and you kind of know what's going on with it.
And you walk into the school, actually, and you can see what's going on there and see the lessons and just what the teachers are doing. And I think also with regards to it's ongoing professional development. It's not just that first week. That first week is obviously everybody's coming in, you're getting to know everybody, you're introducing the meat and potatoes, but it's throughout the years that you're going to continue to make sure that our teachers get that professional development, working with veteran teachers across the United States and all the other schools.
For example, next week our academies are set to have a Zoom meeting and a Skype meeting to see where everybody's at with their development of that.
But at the end of the day, they're not recreating the wheel.
They're not.
There is a database, at least to get started.
Yes.
And I don't want to make that seem like the lesson. Teachers have this stress of like, I'm a former teacher, we live in a society where you get to the point where everything's scripted, and here you go, and you're gonna, and kind of everybody wants it that way. What we've done with LAM, and I think it worked really well, we're part of the interviewing. We help the principal find the staff, and what we do is we have them come in with a lesson plan, and we have them sign.
I was gonna say, when I was hired as a teacher, Mr. Tamargo, he's Mr. Tamargo to me, as well as my principal. When I was hired, I actually had to, as part of my interview process, give a slamified lesson, because I'll say it as a teacher, you're no longer just asked to do what's written in a, you know, in a textbook teacher plan, right? So it does, you do have to bring creativity or something to the table. So I appreciated that in the hiring process, that expectation was set from from the start, as opposed to I get hired and oh, by the way, you're expected to slam.
And the database itself is a living process. Like,
right.
From the database, we find out the teacher saying, this worked, this didn't work, I would have done it better this way, next year I'm going to do it this way. So, I mean, there's collaboration amongst, you know, one of our issues is the geographic space between our schools, so this is one of the ways we try to combat it. The other way is the selection of the leader. We always, to the extent that we can, we try to grow from within with respect to the leader. For instance, we have in the other room our assistant principal from our business, who, you know, look, I mean, we would make the decision today, but we would love for her to have the interest to come in and hopefully be the leader of the school and bring our culture here. At other campuses where we haven't had that luxury, we've taken the planning year and taken the leader and relocated them to another campus to observe an entire year, paid. To absorb the culture and to really identify how this is different than just
and just to point, she's a native of Phoenix. Actually, she went to school down the street, Horizon. So she's actually, she understands. She grew up here. She went to high school. She went to college at Arizona State, and then moved on to Nevada. So she's ready to move back, and that was one of the reasons. If someone who really understands the slam and the culture, she's been able to create that in Nevada, which is a very different. Nevada's very different from what we see in Miami. It's Henderson, if you don't know, it's more of a Mormon community. It's some of the things that we're going to see in where we're looking to be in Mesa. So she really understands that. And I think we look for that leader, just to kind of close your question, to really help guide that. So it's not, and then the teachers own it. They really, really do.
Thank you.
We mentioned a couple times curriculum being a living document or process. Because the curriculum is not clearly defined, it is hard to see the clarity in the overall curricular process. Can you address the specific curricula that will be used to educate students and how these choices will align specifically to both your mission and the needs of the target population?
There's a lot here.
Yeah.
I think first and foremost, the curriculum throughout all of our SLAM schools, although we have certain schools that use the same curriculum per se, depending on the leader, depending on the demographics, depending on the school and the needs, We do identify different curriculum that will be used throughout all of our SLAM schools. For example, you know, you have, well, we just started with our elementary school, so you might use Wonders as that ELA curriculum. We have some use Go Math for the elementary, others use Dern, you know, for math. So it depends. Now, the main thing is to make sure that wherever we're at, whatever state, whatever district, that we are aligning our curriculum with the state standards. And that's the most important thing. And that starts with the, you know, with the identified leader and working through. That's why the planning period is so important, because we are working through to make sure that whatever curriculum is chosen, that it does align with the state standards. And then taking those SLAMified lessons and being able to incorporate those types of lessons based on the curriculum and based on whatever it is that we use.
Once the leader has been chosen, it seems like that person has significant latitude to make the choice as to what programmatic elements would make it into the school's curriculum. How would you ensure, what process do you go to ensure that those choices that a leader makes, supported, I'm sure, by your team, are aligned to the mission and the needs of the target population?
I'm going to address the fact that, so that there is leeway and autonomy for that principal, because again, we don't want to come in and say, well, this works over here, it's got to work for students in the population. However, we have a set of best practices and things that we're seeing are working with a certain type of student. So a student that is probably less engaged in school, students that maybe don't have access to the internet at home, you're not going to provide a type of program that, like, their math, where they're, you know what I mean? So we look at these factors and what's really working. If something is not working for, like, I'll give you an example. We have two schools in Miami, actually. We have a school in West Miami Beach. And one school, our main campus, uses Hardboard as their ELA program. And down the street, the principal uses Springboard, simply because he's comfortable, that's what he learned, and he's able to model that for his teachers and work. So they use a Springboard curriculum for ELA. And, you know, it's fine, it works for their population. What we do as we come in is we're looking, with that principal, we're looking at that data. And one of the things that Alex and the team have developed is mini assessment. Whatever curriculum you're using, you're looking, we're targeting those standards, are they achieving mastery? So those mini assessments help us as a foundation guide. You know, we're not gonna wait till the end of the year to see if this is working. We do, I think, three.
We do the mini assessments with them through USA Test Preps or through iReady.
And so that's the common denominator for all the schools.
Right, that's how we monitor those mini assessments and data chats with our leaders. Tying it to the mission is the supplemental material that we can include. There's an algebra program in Miami that deals with fantasy football, right? And it's pretty neat. They're learning algebra one. Kelly used it. She had 100% of her middle schoolers pass her algebra assessment that year, and they were using this fantasy football curriculum.
They were competing against the Miami Dolphins. The Dolphins are not hard to beat.
I had a mystery player. Yeah.
Right. So a lot of that is how we bring it back to the missions with the supplemental materials. But when you're talking about the core, there's some districts that offer the school more. If you buy, for example, she can attest to that, they're using a Blanco and they're using the ADA program, because in Nevada, the state supports the schools that way. In the District of Miami, Dade County Public Schools, when you're using these certain curriculum, you have access to all of these other materials. So we're not going to tell you, you know, use Blanco and this or that. What is the best fit for your kids? What is the best fit for the school? And then tying it to the mission.
So we are to provide what works. And an example is that, for example, Nevada had a high level ELL student. And one of the issues they were having was, in the state of Nevada, there was no requirement for having a separate component for ELL students, having a separate class if you have a certain number, which we do, because we see that it works. So there wasn't a requirement by the state, and we came in and we said, what's the SLAM requirement? These are the students that are going to be falling behind. We did that, and I can proudly say that this year on their state assessment, they got 10 is the highest you get, 10 out of 10 for those students. So we came in and we said, Achieve 3000 has been a program that's worked with our students, and when you're in a district that we have 20% of our students are English language learners when they come in, you know, that's a huge percentage. So we did that in Nevada. The foundation paid for the program for schools to implement, and they were able to get amazing results that last year. So we do implement the things that work. However, I don't want to say because it's not a cookie cutter. It needs to really fit.
And ultimately, you know, the answer is that we hold our principals very accountable, and we're not afraid to make a change. I mean, my job is to represent our shareholders or our students. You know, if the principals are not and the staff is not providing results, then a change will be made, and we've done that before.
So let me follow up. You indicated when a principal comes in, they have the autonomy to choose the curriculum that they feel will work with the population. What if you have to change a principal after 3 years? Will that person also have that ability to come in and change things?
That actually happened. It actually happened. And to be real, it's when you work in these communities, we don't have the expense of time. These are kids that are losing out on valuable time if that's not working. So we actually had, those are painstaking times, but we're not afraid to make those decisions. We had a situation like that in one of our high schools in Tampa. We had to make that decision. It wasn't working, and it was a mutual decision. It just wasn't the right fit. We have a certain drive as to where we think our students should be, and I think for the most part, our principals have that drive. And there was a set curriculum. There were things that, and again, that situation wasn't curriculum based. But I can tell you, a new principal comes in, they want to have ownership of the program. That doesn't necessarily mean the curriculum. When that person came in, we said, this is what's working, this is what we've established. And she actually just made changes, for example, scheduling. We did more of an extended day program. So there were changes in the program, not necessarily, I'm going to come in and change an entire curriculum. Because obviously, we run a budget.
And I was going to say, here's your budget.
One of the things that was eye-opening was how she prioritized the things on the budget. Completely different from the person that she replaced.
Right.
Okay. That's good to know.
It's not the curriculum, it's the delivery. And I want to say one of the challenges we have in the application is we're kind of advised, don't write specific curriculum because when you go up for renewal, that's going to change over. At the same time, this is something where we have to create those pacing guides and those scope and sequences. And that's where identifying the leader early on is important because they need to be part of that.
Exactly.
Well, that moves right sort of to the next question. No, you're fine. There's concern that since the curriculum or the scope and sequence is probably based in Florida, it's from another state. You're not here in Arizona yet. So you're bringing it with you.
All right.
A pacing guide?
No, we wrote in the action plans, basically, we have pacing guides, for example, for all our programs, but like ELA and math would be very similar because of Common Core, but again, we're still looking at your benchmarks, your science standards, and we would look at what we have and look at what the standards are requesting and basically do a crosswalk of, is this program something that is that is meeting the standards and it's aligned to Arizona? If it's not, that's where that team, because at this point you have a principal,
right?
You have some teachers identified. We're working to support them during the summer process to be able to put that together.
We had to do that with Stern too in Georgia to make sure it aligned with the Georgia milestone assessments that our third and fourth graders take. Their pacing was different than the state's or traditional district, you know, their pacing. So we did like same thing across book and had to kind of reorder the way it was taught to make sure we met the standards by the time the students are taking them out.
And I think it's also important that the planning period is so important with regards to the principal and those identified leaders and teachers because it gives us the opportunity to really look at the standards and curriculum that we're going to choose so that we can align everything.
Okay, I think that you answered it. How, since these are Arizona standards and they're not all Common Core, Arizona is very unique. Mm-hmm. We chose 85% Common Core and then threw in 15% of our own. So that means all the stats that come from other places. So I think you have addressed those concerns. Thank you.
If I could ask a quick follow-up to that, Susan, please. You mentioned in that response that you would still look at your benchmarks here. What do you mean by that?
No, not benchmarks. Okay. We look at the programs that we're offering and see if they're aligned to your benchmarks in terms of
standards.
To your standards.
Okay, to your standards.
Sorry, we're looking at our program, for example, specific curriculum, and then we look at what it's covering, we're looking at the standards, and we're basically saying, okay, is this something that adopts your standards?
Got it, thank you. In the academic systems plan, it's indicated that curricular evaluation and revision will take place twice a year. How will this infrequent revision account for needed changes to ensure that the Arizona state standards are being met within the model that initially comes from Florida?
And again, I think it's more of, I think there might have been the confusion that we're bringing a pacing guide or a scoping sequence from Florida. And I recall, because I did the academic systems plan, so I recall there's a section about how are you going to adopt curriculum and how are you going to revise, where I wrote about the teachers being part of that process in that early summer.
And I think we're more looking at that it's only twice a year.
Right.
It says in the ASP that you will evaluate and revise.
Well, that's our benchmark, that's our standards-based testing, so that we monitor the kids, is that what?
Right, but I think you're saying, in other words, and maybe we were confused about the process, in other words, we're, the way we look at changing curriculum is if something is not working. That doesn't mean that we're not looking at that twice a year. And I think what it was like, twice a year you're assessing overall school-wide, is there anything that needs to be changed? However,
we give a baseline assessment, mm-hmm. and every principal reports their data to the board and reports their action plan to the board. This is how we're going to bridge these gaps and meet the needs. In January, we do it again. Mm-hmm. And there, we tweak it. This may not have worked. It happened in Nevada in October when we saw their school grades came out in October and we said, hold on, your ELL population, we need to do something. And we put in the Achieve 3000 program. This year, we hired an ELL lead and three faculty members to just oversee that program. Of Achieve 3000 and introduce an ELL type curriculum. So we're tweaking it as we go along, and that's why it comes twice a year.
But I think we're saying that, like, this whole leadership team is doing that on a bi-weekly basis, that they're looking at assessments, and they're looking at, that doesn't necessarily mean that the curriculum's not working. That means if a student is not responding, you have a response to intervention team, and you're looking at, because if you did, hey, this isn't working, throw it out the window,
you would be revising everything.
So perhaps a more accurate description would be that the adjustments are made bi-weekly,
right,
driven by the data as reviewed by the school leader,
right,
and
now,
the teaching team.
Right. Changing out an entire curriculum is
not
something that
what you were referring to there is that at least twice a year is when it gets to the board level. And we, you know, look at Ed, you know, every single, when we assess Ed, every single leader, and we decide, you know, hopefully you don't have to make a change there during the year. We have to do that. But,
yeah, I mean, as leaders, principals, they have to do an evaluation, a mid-year evaluation as well that they turn into us, so like that we can see how everything is going along with data. So that would be a time where if we see that something is not going well, then we would move on from there.
And that process is, as you receive your lesson plans and you have an instructional focus calendar, we know we're touching on these standards, and we have avenues where the department can create the assessment for the teacher, and assistant principal or principal can do the same. And basically, it can be through the IRA program, which is an A&E for every standard, assessment for every standard. It could be study item, it could be USA test prep, and then we're checking whether what you're teaching is being done or not.
And again, there are patterns, right? So if it's not working in one classroom, in one class, you're looking, and that's where that school leadership training them to look into that specific, and then determine, oh, it's the curriculum that's not working. But again, half the time, it really isn't it's more on the delivery
and the teacher,
exactly.
Okay, so we're going to switch to a whole other topic. And really, you're in the wheelhouse for you. Talk to me a little bit about whether or not there is any connection between Academica and SLAM, right? And so what I'm meaning is there any, in terms of fiduciary relationship, I don't want to use the word conflict of interest because that's just pejorative. So just thinking about any connection between the two organizations, realizing that ultimately, you are going to be, as a board, required to hold Academica accountable. And so I'm kind of trying to go in that area.
Well, I mean, Academica is a vendor. They provide a service. In my experience, even dating back to my days at the Miami Children's Museum Charter School when I started that I still am the chairman of, they've done a great job for the amount of money that we pay. I mean, they use their economies of scale to provide us with a legal department, a lobbying group, better prices on group insurance, better prices on food delivery. I mean, things that we certainly wouldn't be able to do on our own at a cost that I have, the number two, at least in the area, is Charter Schools USA. And twice in the last 10 years, I've gone out to get it to bid to see if they can do the same services for less amount, and they cannot.
So that was the next question, thinking about other ESPs that you
consider that process, the criteria in that decision-making ultimately have that go?
Well, we basically evaluate all of our vendors, right? You bid it out, you evaluate what do they bring to the table, what kind of value can they bring to the network? And with Academic, that's no different. It's a third-party vendor, and they provide a service. I'm sure everyone's very familiar with the biggest charter management companies in the country. They're one of the largest, they're one of the most respectable, and one of the most reputable, and their fees are so competitive, it's unbelievable. So for the value that they bring with their product and with their service compared to the price, it really becomes a no-brainer.
And so then ultimately, how do you know that they're effective, right? What are the measures, the metrics, quantifiable numbers that you look at and say, we got a good ROI here, not here, not there, and then we have conversations, right? So how does that
mean? For me, I have no doubt that it's the first check that I cut because it's the most valuable I'm receiving. I mean, I started the relationship between SLAM and Academic because I had 8 years of prior experience with them managing the small charter school in Watson Island. They don't have turnover. I've been dealing with the same people for 18 years. I know who to call when I need an answer. All of the forms are done. They are presented to, they are actually hand delivered to my office where I get to sign all the forms so I don't have to go out of my way to do it. Everything from, like I said, health insurance, the food.
About growth, right? One of the things, I think somewhere we talked about growth is a big determiner. So is there any target folded into the Academica contract that is also tied to student outcomes? The relationship, whatever it is.
We pay them a fee per student.
Per student is what
And we're able to negotiate that fee again now, starting to finally be able to use our economies of scale. I think we've got a little bit over 5,000 students now. We're able to use that to negotiate lowering the fee. We've actually lowered the fee, I believe, in Miami, at least one time.
I think it's important to point out that unlike some ESPs or whatever, there's so much CMO, you know. I'm confused about it. Yeah, I don't know what terminology to use anymore, but I think there's a difference because they are charter schools, and they're very big in Florida. But what they do is they hire the principal. They run, I'm only familiar because I know people who work in with them. They hire the principal and they also run the FTEs that come in through that budget and run through the school. So Academic, that's where this board has.
We made a very intentional decision to move away from that model. We're not comfortable with that.
If you break your contract, then your principal leaves, and you're right. It's almost like you're.
We want to have that.
But to answer your question, we're not married to Academic. If somebody else can provide what they provide at a cheaper rate, absolutely we do it.
No connection at the upper levels in terms of founders and co-founders and upper level leadership connections between the two organizations?
I've gotten to know them.
I just want to make sure that I'm just asking about if you share a relationship now amongst the upper level leadership staff or team of either organization.
No.
That's fine with that question. Thinking now about your Arizona board and local representation, how are you? Where are you?
We want to add the right person again. But globally, I'm thinking that I really want to use this to drive the relationship with Major League Baseball. So I have a great relationship with Yasmani Grandal, who's the catcher on the Milwaukee Brewers. His dad works for us at our SLAM Miami campus. He lives in Peoria. He's moving. He may be moving to Mesa, but he's going to grade in the greater Phoenix area. And he's the person who I would like for him. I think he'd be open to it, and I think he would be a wonderful member to add to our board here. That would help us also. I think that would make Major League Baseball happy. That would help us also try to grow our relationship with Major League Baseball here.
So give me a visual. Who's currently on the board? In terms of numbers, who do you have?
We have three.
Great. And then you're looking to add how many more?
Potentially two.
You would either want a board of five or a seven. I would think that boards of five have worked for us traditionally.
And to give a 30,000 foot view of the models are a little bit different in Nevada. So we serve on the boards in the Florida schools. Nevada has its own board. Atlanta has its own board. And here, so what we do is we always try to open with the founding board members because we want to keep the integrity and the fidelity of the mission and the goal on point. And then once we start seeing that maybe there's stabilization or maybe everything is the way that we envision it in that specific area, then we can, I guess we can move and bring in some other board members and expand the board in a different way, and even having completely different board as we do in Nevada.
Because we are the board of the
Sonoma. I read that. So right. You're the corporate board, and you were very clear.
No. The corporate board?
So in your application, we just reviewed this, that there is, your plan is to have one board and not to have local boards. But now you're saying that you're going to have state boards?
And we've been flexible because we've been trying to find the best way to expand, right? So the Slam Foundation, its sole purpose is to service and support the Slams. And really, it's almost the way I view it is, you know, it's almost like a franchise model. We want to go and make sure that through Burger King, that each one of our Slams is serving Whoppers and not Big Macs. And we want to make sure that we are what we say we are. So what we've done in many places is that the three of us, are the founding board of many of our locations. And then as we are happy with people joining our board, we may grow it to 5 or 7. And if we're happy with the people there, we may leave. Like at a certain point, like we've got enough to do, but like, so maybe.
And it's dependent on each area, right? We make it very clear that each slam is particular and specific to the needs of that area and what makes sense for that area. So whereas...
And we have no interest in, I mean, all of us, none of us are paid. We have no interest in staying or being on every board. I mean, we just want to make sure that what we started gets, you know, gets
going. We want the mission, and we want to make sure that the mission is executed the way that it has to be.
Can you give me an example of a board that you have felt strong enough now? I can leave. We built
Nevada and Atlanta.
Atlanta now.
Yeah,
Atlanta now. Finally. So they're running
themselves. Yes. And you're still the relationship.
Or the Atlanta board. Do you call it the Atlanta board?
Slam Atlanta.
So there is still, at that point, there's an affiliation agreement between the Slam Foundation and the local board. And I mean, we participate in the board meetings, and we're all friends. We all, but we're not physically on their board anymore.
But to point out, we support the academic program, so we go and we monitor and we work with the principal. If we see that the principal is not, applying, we have those conversations with the board. And so one of the things, in order to be a Slam school in that regard, is we need to keep making sure that we're driving student success, and we have that academic. So that's the relationship that we have with that.
Just because we're not on the board doesn't mean they're allowed to go
right.
We monitor, there's accountability, and there's systems in place to make sure that happens.
I'm good, thank you.
Recruiting staff is one of the biggest issues for new charter schools that open, especially here in Arizona. How are you going to find these teachers that are highly qualified in each of your grade levels and subject areas?
Before Alex takes over that, I mean, just as an overarching. We've been very fortunate. We've been very different than any of my other experiences in education, where people actually come to us. So when we open Miami or we open in any new location, not only do we have internal people who want to move there from our family, but we have people who are former coaches or former players who go and want to be coached. So we get flooded, thankfully, with many qualified people who want to come. We also have a national, which I was going to say at my closing, we have a national radio station. We have an XM satellite radio station run out of Miami. So a lot of radio folks want to come, people who perhaps want to either kickstart their career again, or people who have retired and want to serve the community, come to us to get airtime to help the students put on the programming. So we've been very fortunate. We've got a long list of retired players and coaches and people who help us in a number of capacities. That's not everybody, and for the rest of the people.
And if you just spend one moment, Alex, put your mouth for one more second. I can't tell you how many times that question is raised in these type of interviews about the shortage of teachers in the communities and in the areas, and how are we going to address that challenge. And just to reiterate what Renee said, it's never been an issue for us. We've never had trouble recruiting talented instructional staff for any of our schools. I can't maybe give a reason as to why that is. It's just not a challenge that we've experienced.
And before we there's two key things that we're doing right now just on the local effort, because I know one thing is obviously that future principal,
yes,
actually, because she's part of the Slam model, already has three people she wants to, teachers that she wants to bring on board, and that has happened. And we're all about being able, like, our Miami teacher moved to Nevada to run the sports medicine program.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a K-5, it's a little different than the high school space. The STEM initiative in that program, we have two partners that we've been working very closely with. One is Verizon, the Verizon Foundation. The Slam Miami program is a Ville school. If you're not familiar, it's a Verizon Innovation Learning School. It's a program where the kids get one-to-one iPads and a two-year plan to take for free. So these are students, we have 10% homeless population. So these are students that never have, some of them don't have access to internet. We wrote that grant a couple years ago, and we're going to be the first 5G lab in the state of Florida that's going to be run out of Miami, sponsored by Verizon. I've reached out to them because as we move into an area like this, we imagine that we're going to be Taiwan, we're going to serve that population. So that program is very heavily STEM-based. They come and train all the teachers as part of the foundation because they're doing a study as to, you know, they have a similar school with the same demographics, and they're doing a study as to is STEM and technology and how that's affecting us. So through that foundation, we have access to, they're all over the country, so we do have access to be able to find those qualified educators. And then the other partnership that we established in Florida was the WASET, who are locally, they're here. They're in Arizona, Steve Wozniak was WASET. But what we did is, when we're looking at the elementary program, we vetted a lot of STEM programs. And one of the things that we found is that teachers are really scared of that. Teachers are, if they don't understand coding, robotics, it's very hard to find them because we've been trying to find them, right? And if they can do that work, they can make $100,000, they don't want to come teach. Not in an urban middle school. So that's been a challenge that we've been addressing. And what we found was through the WASED program, we actually have access to modules and lessons and programs where we can train our own teachers to be able to integrate this into the curriculum. And they're not afraid of it, they're excited about it. Because
they're more like facilitators.
Yeah, drove drones, but we started a drone program. And so now the teachers are excited because they have the support. So I think on the outreach end, we're reaching out to those two organizations to make sure that we get access to local educators who may want to take on this initiative.
I'd like to hear
it. What they said, and that's what it
is. So they stole my thunder. But no, it's been an interesting process everywhere we've opened. And I remember in Miami, we hired teachers from Georgia, from Kentucky, from the Carolinas, up and down the state of Florida. We had a person flying from Portland, Oregon to interview because they wanted to be part of this. And that same synergy has taken place in Nevada. We interviewed
a teacher.
We interviewed Shen Evers over there. Well, the good thing about Shen Evers, who's a front runner for this position here, she's coming back home to Arizona. She's coming back to this neighborhood where she graduated high school from, with three teachers who the other principals but that's okay, we'll talk to Dan Triano up there. But I think that in itself is gonna help.
And you
just
know,
having her.
And I think also reaching out to the universities and getting interns and teachers or potential teachers who are interested, that's also a way of recruiting and making sure that we have qualified teachers.
One thing that Academica Virtual is now rolling out is for your qualified teachers, maybe in the subject area that they're teaching, but maybe a new teacher, like year one, or was a math major but wasn't an education major. So we're now, I was a part of this pilot where you have a master teacher that will actually zoom in to the classroom, and they will run the lesson, and the teacher there, let's say in Arizona, will be the support for that particular day or period or whatever. So one, the students are definitely receiving great instruction because you have the master teacher, but two, that teacher in the room is learning some of those strategies. So we're also, that's something new that we rolled out this year to hit certain areas that have trouble getting sometimes these experienced, highly qualified teachers.
Thank you.
When is your enrollment period, and how will that time frame ensure you have enough students for the opening of school?
Well, I think that's going to depend on the approval of the charter school. Hopefully we have enough time to make sure that we do get it. We always start off with interest forms. That's the main thing. So let's just say December comes along and we know that we are going to be coming over to Arizona. We'll have interest forms to start seeing who's interested, what is the population like, who are we going to be serving. And then from there, we start doing the registration or the application process. We'd like to start, I know most of our schools, they like to start around December, the process, so it gives us enough time to see what the interest is like. And then depending on basically the number of applicants, do we have an overabundance where we have to go into a lottery process? But I know most of our schools by February, they already identify the students and starting to register students, just to give us enough time to provide, you know, for that principal also to do from open houses. If we, you know, we already have an established location, you know, making sure that we have everything put together, but we want to make sure that we have enough time to be able to start that process. If there's a lottery process that we need to have, you know, to have that done as well.
In Hillsborough County, it started with a, you know, meetings at a church.
Yep, that's the other thing.
On a website and reaching out to people, and then that would spread out. And we had a similar time frame from December through August. And we filled it with 600 students. It was a tireless effort from my team, but.
For informational meetings, we already had established a year it spans in different times. And then based on those meetings, the last part of the process was the registration. But I think that's the outreach you have to do. So that's why we need that year.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Shannon, can I ask how much time you have?
About 34 minutes.
How long?
34.
34. Thank you. Perfect.
In the personnel plan, a job description with required tasks is included for an assistant principal position. Since that position is not used during the first 3 years of operation, who will take over those job responsibilities, specifically the oversight of research-based curriculum and talent development? Those job descriptions were not included in the principal's job description.
I mean, the principal normally will be taking on, there's usually a lead teacher as well that assists. That lead teacher normally becomes that assistant principal, you know, due to budgets. Probably, you know, the first 3 years is tough. So, you know, we just want to make sure, depending on, you know, if there is an enrollment where we are able to, let's say, hire an assistant principal, maybe year two, maybe it is year one. We started in Tampa.
Our Osceola program, our Slam Osceola School, is just because they're on a field in the park, and we're waiting on the expansion. We're expanding with the city, actually, for that development of, they're redeveloping that area, and we're going to have a new building. She's at capacity of 240 students.
Yeah.
So she is.
She's at our
specialist.
She is
She is everything. So when you look at a PLC, she's kind of the lead on
the
PLC.
But the answer is
you know it's not sustainable. So I'm kind of
right. It's not. You also have your department heads. You identify as a principal, as a leader, you're going to identify your core. It may not be a counselor the first time, but maybe someone that you are identifying to eventually be a counselor, your lead teachers, your department heads, your veteran teachers, and all of those become part. You start, you know, identifying. There's some people who, like, I have certain teachers who have an ESC background, and they start doing some collaboration with those students, and then now I have actually one who, she is my co-lab teacher now, and that is all she does, where she started as a math teacher and incorporating, you know, certain collaborations. So as a leader, you're identifying people who are going to be part of that. But the
SLAM Foundation steps up in Academica too, in those situations, especially in the smaller schools where, you know, you don't have a top heavy to do all those roles. I mean, the SLAM Foundation has played an integral role in Atlanta. Same thing, it started in the church. It's limited just by the number of seats. So they don't have the principal, assistant principal, all that support. Like, they really stepped up and have been more involved in taking on some of the like curriculum selection. Millie and I, like, instead of sending the principal out to go vet the STEM curriculums, like, we went to the trainings and of two different curriculums, and then reported back to the principal and said, between these two, we think this makes the most sense. I mean, the more the principal can stay and be the leader in their school. So from an academic perspective, that's some of the responsibilities I think that the foundation and Academica has taken on. And from the talent, you know, search as well, like, it's definitely not my skill set, but I've been going to these career fairs and talking my head up all day, you know, like, so we definitely step up in those areas too. Again, I'm not saying that's a sustainable thing, but until you grow and can bring in that AP or leave,
then we're going to make sure that we
provide. Right, there's no budgetary concern that's going to be left unmatched. That's why we're here as a foundation.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay.
So, Tracy, before you ask that question, you mentioned the SLAM Foundation. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk us through, you have the SLAM Foundation, you have the SLAM Board, and you have Academica. How does it all work?
We have the SLAM Foundation Board,
okay.
Which is basically, imagine a franchise model. We are the overarching decision makers who try to, we identify what we're going to open, we identify a leader, we create a board, which usually starts with us. Hopefully, we eventually wean ourselves off that board,
yes.
Us three. Academica plays no role in that process. Academica is a vendor. They have a good results for us over, for SLAM for 10 years, and I've seen that, their results for 18 years. But they, they play, they will play a role if we ask them to. Like, if for instance, if we haven't been able to identify a leader from within our network in an area where they have other schools, we may ask them, like, is there anybody who would be willing to move? What do you know about these people?
So you poach from other schools who are also.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Poach.
We help people fulfill their dreams by moving to the school that they want to go.
There's something called Doral Leadership. Well, Alex, you just
Doral Leadership.
I help out with the Doral Leadership. I'm on their board now. The Doral Leadership Program basically is anyone who's interested in being an administrator and pursuing that career. We have a process where we interview. In Miami, we have 127 people. I've interviewed all of them. We have South Florida, Central Florida, Texas. We have Nevada. We have the Doral Leadership is in all those areas. So we interviewed over 127 people for 30 positions, and then we have modules where we teach them the charter way to run a school, because there are some differences when you're budgeting and staffing and so on and so forth. And so from there, there's emails that go across all the networks.
Quite a school.
Okay. All the networks when a school opens and anyone can.
I had it from us.
So we have SLAM Foundation, then there's SLAM, and then there's Academica. So you got to SLAM Foundation, you were just about to start talking about SLAM.
So SLAM Inc. is the entity that would operate the school. That's the governing board, that's the principal reports to. That is
who's managing. The nonprofit.
That's your people right there.
The start and an additional as
right.
No.
Okay, so my question is, so SLAM Foundation, we work for them.
Yes.
You work for the board?
Yes.
I thought SLAM Foundation.
The SLAM Foundation board.
Yes, but we're just your staff. You're staff. We're not board members. We're staff of the foundation. What we do is the foundation was started by the same board in 2015 to help support the school. It doesn't authorize or have actual goals. Okay. So it's the curriculum, the professional development, the talent search. We're basically on the ground helping to support the school.
Okay.
I got it.
Loans if they need it.
Right. A lot of the startup funds that we do, we do that because
So that comes to the money part. The SLAM Foundation, do you have a fundraising arm?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
You guys do.
Yeah, we have facilitated loans. We do fundraisers. We now also have our SLAM Radio, which is a national radio where people they underwrite portions of it in order to have their executives interviewed by our students, or in order to have, we don't have calls to action, but there are ways that we can get private interests involved.
That generates money? The radio station does?
Yes.
You can give out ads?
We don't give ads. We don't have calls to action.
Right.
We don't give out calls to action. Imagine like the PBS model. What we can do is we can have the president of a bank who wants to either give a grant or do something, but then now we're going to have that president being interviewed by our students and being spotlighted on our channel.
So they sort of sponsor that piece to have their person on.
They can underwrite
it. Okay, we have private. Whoever has come to tour, we do a lot of tours from Miami, and thanks to Armando, people's support, we've gotten a lot of donations on the private sector.
And we get the Marlins have been very generous with us supporting the mission.
Okay. So we have private fundraising on the foundation to be able to support the schools. Okay.
I have a quick follow-up question around governance. So the three of you act as the board of, in this case, SLAM Inc. You're also acting as the board of a variety of other charter schools. How often do you specifically meet in your capacity as board members of this particular entity? And how do you ensure in all of your other board roles that you are staying compliant with, in our case, Arizona's open meeting law?
So So we have a board meeting for every single board, an open public board meeting at least once a quarter. Often, we as a foundation have a monthly planning meeting where we identify issues, and I mean, that's not a board meeting, but if we need to, very often we will convene another special board meeting whenever we have to, but our calendars are full of board meetings, and they are regular occurrences.
But I just want to point out, because the schools, at least in Florida, they're on the board, all the schools are under that same board.
Right.
So it's one board meeting.
Exactly.
We're all the way forward.
So all the boards.
Nevada has their own board, Atlanta has their own board.
So they don't have to.
Right. And so when you're meeting as part of the Florida board, which oversees all of the schools in Florida, you would also be constituting a quorum for the Arizona board.
You would end the meeting and restart it for Arizona.
During that time, though, you are, the quorum is together. And so how do you navigate those?
Open meeting
laws. Does the open meeting law in Arizona require any time? So if all the three of us were to have dinner together, that's a
meeting? This would be an open meeting law in Arizona.
Really?
Right,
that's
right,
yeah. Different than Florida.
Yes.
And because you would first have to establish quorum, then call a specific meeting to order under Florida law. Here, just the concurrence of the three people,
yes,
it constitutes a quorum.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't know, because we don't know how many people ultimately you'd have on the board. If
two of you are together,
correct. That's
right.
What we're talking about.
Two of you are texting.
Yes.
I mean,
that violates the meeting law.
Yeah, that would.
Arizona
is. That would accelerate and expedite the. What I was saying, that each area is, we're very specific when we address the meetings. Nevada has their own board member, Atlanta has their own board.
But even though this sounds like this could actually be a good thing, because we'll notice, I mean, all of our, we all benefit from talking to each other as often as possible, so we could notice, like, I don't know what the notice period is, but we could notice that there's going to be a board meeting here too.
So let's just pretend Wednesday night, 6:00, you're getting together. So first we're going to talk about Florida. Then we're going to close that out. Is that what you were saying?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to reopen it again, and we're going to talk about Georgia.
Right. And it would be posted separately.
Right.
And
each
to me.
Correct.
Yeah. And it would
we try to encourage in person meetings, but some people may call in, and then they'll know that they're to call in. You know, at this
and
time.
The expectation is that the Georgia team will call in and share the data of their edits.
Absolutely. Because they have their own agenda set for that.
Right.
Right.
And the Florida team's going to call in and talk about
their data.
They're not always the same day, but if we can make
it easier.
Last one. Let's talk about the role that the governing board will play in retention decisions. We're talking specifically student retention decisions.
Well, as a board, I mean, really, we leave it up to the principal in the sense of the plan of action that principal has. If we see, for example, I believe in Tampa, we have a, right now we lost a few students, so we want to know what the plan of action is.
No, we're not saying students.
Retaining.
I'm sorry.
Is the board involved in any of those kinds of decisions?
I can't recall.
That's also principal. I mean, we'll have like set guidelines with regards to, you know, the standards and what the student is supposed to be, where the student is supposed to be at, and then from there we move
on. So it sounds like what we saw in the application, and that's what I pulled up here. We're gonna find it looking. It just caught our eye, and so that's how ultimately inputting one of the questions.
Number five, can you do this?
decision formally in writing.
Is that mastery in your motion?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, let's find out. All right.
Yeah, they can appeal. So
they can appeal.
It's the, it would be the principal's decision, and if for some reason, just like in any other traditional district, if a principal, if it, a student is retained, they're the principal, or the, I'm sorry, the parents will have a right to appeal to a higher authority if they feel, for whatever reason, like for example, if there wasn't communication throughout the year and all of a sudden there's this meeting that says we're retaining a student, and the principal says that there has to be some sort of checks and balances, and in which case I would think that that parent could go and say, this is the first time I've ever heard that my child was in danger of being held back. And at that point, it would be appealed to the governing board. But not in the decision to retain the student.
That's more like the parent has the right to go to a board meeting to address the
issues. Exactly, to address the issues, correct.
Yeah. Right, but in thinking about what Kelly said, the principal is not going to allow that to happen, is not going to allow a parent not to be notified. They're going to follow your procedures, right? I just find it very interesting because we retain kids in our school and never would we...
You know, it's just question in other states.
It's like the principal or head of the school has the final say.
Exactly.
So it's very...
It's their decision. It's in our history. It's never been escalated at a board level.
Yeah,
we
never have to.
I just thought that was very out of character for schools as I know it.
The board is going to be the principal.
Yeah, we would have just never gotten to that.
In Georgia, we actually have to define an appeals process. So when we, you know, because Arizona is very open to starting from... There aren't guidelines per se of what that we have to follow because it's a state charter as opposed to following the district, right? So I guess in the development to cover our bases, that is a requirement in Georgia to have an official appeals process. I wanted to be sure that there was an appeals process.
I do want to make sure we do know that Arizona does have rules around retention.
No, I'm sorry, of course. I didn't mean that, but the specific process we don't have to follow. There's not a district guide that we follow. There's a state statute, obviously, that we have to be in compliance with. But I was saying, like in Miami-Dade, they have a promotion and retention that we have to follow. That's not determined by SLAM Miami.
The principal makes that decision.
Absolutely.
I mean, we'll have board meetings.
Right.
I'm sure this is similar here, but we help support and facilitate the conflict resolution process, and you know, we'll have parents appeal this by anything, even if it's not written.
But it's not really going to come back. The way I see it is that the board is going to look to see if somebody's claiming that there was some sort of failure in due process because they didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, and as conflict resolution, my cell phone is, I mean, all of it, I get calls whenever a parent disagrees. You know, and I'm almost like a therapist. I'm like, well,
your therapist. I do have one question that got left out. Are all SLAM schools managed by academia?
Yes.
Yes.
All 10 of them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I have one more question, but I'm going to look.
Okay, do you have something else here?
This is a small issue, a common board configuration. I'm just curious if you can tell me. I know what it is, but I'm just curious what yours is. So, in every SLAM classroom that I walk in, there's a common board configuration.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You have your essential question, your objective, activities that are going in. You'll have your home learning. Basically, I mean, it's the SLAMified lesson will be identified there as well. So everyone has that type of, and it's more also for the kids to know as well. This is what we're doing today. This is what it is that we're doing. So that's what it would look like.
Okay. All right. You now have 5 minutes.
Excellent.
Make a closing statement.
I will be told again that I have 1 minute left and I will have so many more
Shannon
things I want to share.
Good about that.
Thank you all for the opportunity to come and share our story and hopefully move towards some sort of approval so that we can open a school here. I hope that our enthusiasm and our dedication is apparent. I mean, everybody here really gives all of themselves to this mission to try to you know, create opportunities. I know that most of us here are children of immigrants who have really fought to be able to attain the American dream, and we hope to pass that on. I can share with you three stories that have happened in my journey with SLAMP that have really touched me and really, you know, motivated me to continue and to try to make this my mission as I go forward. And one of them was very early on. Alex was the principal at SLAMP Miami, and I walked in and I was, you know, very proud of the building, and we have a beautiful facility. And I remember I walked into the cafeteria, and it's a Monday morning, and I see one particular child go back, and I said, "See a meeting." And he went back and he got more food, and he stuffed his face really quickly, and he went back and he got more food. And I said, "Alex," I said, "this joker, like, I mean, like, don't we have, like, this kid's just going in anymore?" And Alex said, "Well," and he knew his name. He's like, "That's so-and-so. And, you know, I just want you to know that he didn't eat over the weekend. So this is the first time he's eating since Friday." So, I mean, that to me was like a very impactful situation that occurred. The second one that I want to share is, 2 years ago, we had a graduate who was the salutatorian of SLAMP Miami, and he was an incredible academic achiever, and he got himself a scholarship to George Washington University, and a partial scholarship, and we were able to come up, the foundation came up with the money to give him a full scholarship, and he called me about a week later, he was very thankful, and he told me that nobody knew it, but he was homeless, and his entire senior year, he lived in a car with his father, and to me, that was incredible, because he was a very good-looking kid, always well-dressed, had a girlfriend. I, you know, I'm thinking to myself, how does this guy have a social life if he's living in a car? But no one would have ever known. Happiest kid, most positive kid you'll ever see. And yet, you know, he didn't even let me know that until after he had already achieved what he achieved. So that was another moment that was incredibly impactful. And then, you know, lastly is that every single year, I like to go in during open houses and just try to greet some of the kids who are incoming into our sixth grade, into our middle school. And a lot of the time we get pushback from parents that tell us, you know, why do you keep telling our kids that they're going to go to college? Like, we don't want our kids to go to college. Like, in fact, if they would drop out, that would be great, because they could get a job and we would have another paycheck coming into the house. And it's a real struggle in the beginning to tell them, like, listen, trust us. I understand that you're out working to better, you know, the lot in life for your children. And this is part of that. You know, your child will have the option to go to college, and we're going to try to facilitate not only their development academically, but their ability to go out and hopefully spend as little amount of money and time in college as possible. And it happens every single time that when we're in graduation, some of the same parents that I'll remember will come up to me and thank me and say, like, you know, my kid got a scholarship to, you know, fill in the blank school. We can't believe it. This is the first person in the history of our family to go to college. And it always strikes me that, you know, this isn't easy, right? This is a very difficult thing, and it's an ongoing thing. It's something that we have all voluntarily chosen to put something in our life that you know, was very demanding. And every day we get a phone call, and every day we have to take a trip, and we have, you know, we all, you know, especially Tony and I, we're not educators. You know, we have law firms that we're running, and we have people that are calling us every 15 seconds to say that this needs to be done. We have clients who are unhappy, and, you know, you can imagine. And yet this, we gravitate towards this because this is what helps fulfill us. You know, our normal jobs fulfill us, but this is what really fills us with this feeling that we are hopefully being able to impact a future generation and improve communities and improve the country. And, you know, I love Arizona, I love Phoenix, I love Mesa. I think we've identified it as a fit, not only demographically, culturally, and we're hopeful that you all will allow us to come here and to make a similar difference in this community.
If I may say something, do I have any time?
You have, yeah, like 45 seconds.
36 seconds.
I just want to say that we are so excited and we're so eager for the opportunity. We know the Mesa community. It's the community that we serve. We want to serve it. We're excited to serve it, and we know how to serve it well. And we welcome the opportunity, and we ask you for the opportunity to allow us to serve it.
And this is Tony Mesa speaking, so it's possible that his great grandfather.
My great grandfather.
One cool thing, we have three scientists graduating this year. And they're all above 90%
over there.
Graduation.
Wow. So that's awesome.
Our slam on yet last year had a 100% high school graduation rate.
That is amazing.
Thank you all so much.
Okay, here, let me tell you about next steps. First of all, thank you.
we're going to conclude the interview and I'll give you all the steps. The technical review panel will evaluate the scores from the review of your written application package, as well as the findings of the interview panel. This will include whether your written application package met the scoring criteria specified in the application, and whether the interview panel finds sufficient capacity to operate a charter school. Next, a recommendation report will be submitted to board staff and will be presented to the board at the December 9th, 2019 meeting. This will be a full day meeting that will begin at 9 a.m. We anticipate that this will be a long meeting, so please plan for the possibility that your application being considered on December 10th if the meeting runs long. If you have any questions about the next steps, please contact Rachel Hanna, the board's assistant director of charter support and accountability. You now have a copy. You got it, yeah. So once again, the Arizona State Board for Charter Schools, the technical review panel, and board staff would like to thank you for coming in today and for your interest in providing quality educational choice to the children of Arizona. Safe travels.
Thank you.